Miss Viva Las Vegas is the ultimate pageant. Every girl wants to be Miss Viva Las Vegas. It's the Miss America of the rock and film genre.
Of all the pinup contests all over the world, Miss Viva Las Vegas is the most prestigious contest.
It's time for OWC Radio. Tech Talk with Creatives. Conversations with host Serena Catania.
Hello and welcome back. I am speaking today with a good friend, Dan Halperin, who I've known for years through both of our affiliations with the Producers Guild. We were on the diversity committee together for a long, long time, and I've always admired his work. He's an independent film, TV producer, and director, and he has a film called Bombshells and Dollies. Dan, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to talk to me. I know there's a lot that you can teach people about independent documentaries.
Yes, great to be here, Serena.
So let's just talk a little bit before we get started, if you don't mind, about a couple of the projects that are in your past. So you're known for a series that was on Showtime called Picture Windows. Tell us about that for a moment.
Well, indeed. Picture Windows was a series that was an anthology series. And my partners and I created it, and it was a concept of bringing famous paintings, famous pieces of art to life cinematically. So each episode was to begin with an artwork, which in some way would magically transform from still to motion. And we often paired those paintings or drawings, et cetera, with a short piece of fiction. So it was a combination of art plus literature equaling great cinema. And we made seven half-hour episodes for Showtime. I wrote and directed the pilot in which I brought to life Everett Hopper's famous painting, Nighthawks, and put it together with a wonderful short story by a Chicago writer named Harry Mark Petrakis. And we continued with that because our partner on that series, Norman Jewison, also directed an episode. Showtime was very attracted to that concept. So we ended up doing shows with Norman, Bob Rafelson, and Peter Bogdanovich, John Borman, Joe Dante, and Jonathan Kaplan. And then we probably had 20-some additional directors lined up to do more episodes. But I think we're a little bit ahead of the time with that series, and Showtime didn't renew us for another season. But I will tell you that we're looking to bring it back now because we think in this era of kind of short-form media that it's really quite perfect for it. So we're in the process of taking that show out and reviving it.
Well, because I was listening to your description of it thinking, whew, I'd like to see that. I'd like to see that tonight. That would be great. I wish you good luck with that. So you won some awards for that series, right?
Well, we did receive an Emmy as well as two Cable Ace Awards. At that time, the cable programming did not compete for Emmys. So they competed for Cable Ace Awards. Now it would have been an Emmy, maybe, you know, and gotten two Emmys, but we had two Cable Ace Awards as well.
So pick another favorite project and tell us about it. I think you had one on PBS, right?
Yes, on PBS, myself and my company created and produced a television series called Phenomenon, The Lost Archive. And there was a documentary series, which we did 14 one-hour episodes, in which we addressed kind of little-known scientific facts or stories that, you know, were kind of underexplored. And we presented like we had a secret archive underneath Washington, D.C., where the secrets were kept. Might have been a little bit prescient and ahead of its time. And then we would kind of do an expose on these various different topics. I wrote and directed an episode, for example, Lost Bombs, and how the American government has knowingly lost 14 nuclear bombs across the time that have already been jettisoned from aircraft or lost overboard at sea. And most, if not many of them, are still out there. And those are the ones we know about. And those are the ones that we know that the American government cops to, but as well as we don't know what other foreign governments might have in terms of nuclear weapons that are sitting allegedly lost or disposed of in various places.
It amazes me when I talk to documentary filmmakers how attuned they are to the stories that resonate with them. I mean, these films take a long time to make. Bombshells and Dollies caught my eye.
Bombshells and Dollies is a look at the contemporary pinup girl phenomenon. And what it is, you know, there's a lot of women today that are living a 1940s and 1950s lifestyle, as well as a form of 1940s and 1950s presentation as far as their hair, makeup, and clothing style. And what I will say, kind of addressing both things, kind of how I got into it, is that a colleague of mine had an idea for a television series, and I had avoided scripted, you know, shows, but he convinced me this particular one would be interesting. Part of his passion is involved in the car racing world, but he had an idea about a show that dealt with women who drove cars, but also women who drove these period cars, and then also had a fashion component because they also lived and presented themselves in this sort of period lifestyle. And he said that the place where we could meet those people would be at something called Viva Las Vegas Rockabilly Weekend, which is an annual event that happens every Easter weekend in Las Vegas, where 25,000 fans of all things rockabilly, vintage culture, vintage lifestyle take over the Orleans Hotel for 4 days. And essentially the hotel turns into the 1950s, 1940s for that duration. And so we went there to meet these people. Fortunately, we really didn't find that many women at that time, you know, who worked on cars and so forth. So, and I'd say that was like in 2013, but we did shoot a sizzle reel and then came back to shoot another sizzle reel in 2014. But what we found some interest with some buyers, but it didn't get total buy-in that we wanted. But I really had recognized that there was something special about these women. And I thought it would be interesting that there'd be interest in, you know, window into an unusual and unique lifestyle. And I took that sizzle reel out to some buyers, and they said, we like that. And what we would do is script some material and then get the ladies to conflict and, you know, fight. And they said, that's the way we think we could create a show. And I took that back to the women, particularly the ones that participate or run the pinup contest that happens at Viva Las Vegas Rockabilly Weekend, the Miss Viva Las Vegas Pinup Contest, which is the largest and most heralded pinup contest in the world of its type. And my mind was blown when they told me, no, we would never do that. We would never lower our presentation in that way and be exploited. And honestly, I had first looked at it in a rather exploitive way myself. I thought, oh, you know, this would be an interesting show and we could sell that. And when they said that to me, it changed my whole mind. Because at first I thought, it's silly that women dress up in a period style and spend hours and hours on their hair and makeup and travel with crates full of clothes and change, you know, into different fashion ensembles several times a day. That takes hours, hours of preparation. And when they said that to me, I took a deeper look and said, this is really quite fascinating. And what I found was a subculture of people in this particular group that I had met, the ones who had created this contest. I realized that this was a contest about beauty as much on the inside as on the outside. And it was also a culture that advocated freedom of self-expression, self-respect, and body positivity, and an exploration of how every woman has the right to look and feel gorgeous. And that there was a total acceptance there of diversity and of every other aspect of female community. And then I decided to follow the contest of a particular year where only 3 out of the 12 were American. So it also made me realize how this was an incredibly international movement and how it's a celebration of Americana and how that celebration happens all over the world, and wanted to explore why is that? Why are people still so engaged and in love with this period of American history?
Did you get any pushback at all from the Me Too movement or feminists who assumed without really knowing that this might be exploitive? How did you feel about all of that?
I got that at almost every turn. And everybody, I think, immediately looks at this and feels that it's exploitive. And so that was the thing that fascinated me, is that, you know, once people take a look at the film, they realize that women who are living this lifestyle, while they are exploring their physical and sexual presentation, they are embracing it and owning it and simultaneously owning their power as a woman. And that is something that evolved to me very much out of World War II, and particularly how when the American GIs were serving overseas and there was a shortage of men in America because they're overseas fighting the war, that women took over all of the men's positions in the workforce, meaning from office positions to industrial manufacturing positions and everything else, you know, from milkman and mail person, et cetera. So it goes from these two elements where they're embracing their sexuality because the GIs, you know, collected these pictures they put up on their walls and their lockers, by their bunks and their ships, essentially like the girl next door, the sensation of the girl next door. And it might be kind of a cheesecakey picture, which people kind of relate to the picture of, you know, Betty Grable in a bathing suit. But girls next door were doing that. And the word is for the GIs, it gave them some sense of home and something that they were fighting for. So there's that component. But then the flip side was the Rosie the Riveter component of it. So it's kind of a twofold advancement for women of embracing their physicality and their sexuality, as well as their ability to do anything that a man can do. And I think that's the attitude that the women today that are practicing this, you know, form of presentation are owning, as well as taking the best of those elements, because indeed, you know, the 40s and 50s was also a time where women were still fighting for elements of suffrage. They're taking the best of that era, certain elements of chivalry, et cetera, that existed in that time, and combining it with today and the things that they find empowering today, which, you know, might be their expression through social media, being business persons, et cetera. And that's the kind of the aspect of this community that I focused on, were these very engaged women that are engaged in their communities, they're engaged in commerce, and as well as I said, embracing their femininity.
Well, they're beautiful, they're intelligent, they're positive, they're happy. I watched this movie, and to a small degree, well, not a small degree, to a large degree, it brought me back to who I am as a woman. And I think that over the last couple of decades, we've lost a little bit of our femininity in the middle of the feminist movement. And you know, I have to remind you, I'm a woman that grew up in a time when we were burning our bras and we were trying to be at an equal level with men in the workforce, and it was an uphill fight all the time. And in the middle of all of that, I've seen relationships between men and women really deteriorate. And there seems to be a lack of respect on both sides. And this movie reminded me of how we can still have that. And I have recommended this movie to women who are millennials, to women who are in their 40s, and they're loving it. So I'm really happy that you made it. And let's tell people a little bit about the Las Vegas event and how it works. There's cars and women, two things that are absolutely fascinating.
I had no knowledge or experience in either the rockabilly scene or the car scene. And I think that's a benefit that we get to experience as documentary makers and filmmakers in general, is we throw ourselves into an environment, into a world for whatever period of time it takes to put a project together. And it is something that I knew nothing about. It was an exploration and a learning experience for myself. So every day, the questions I was asking as I interviewed people in that world or these women were not only things that that I was exploring for my audience, but for myself. You know, I went on this very educational path. Now, my producing as partner on the project, a fellow named Dane Krogman, is a professor at the University of North Carolina School for the Arts. He is both a art and film professor. He teaches courses also in Japanese art forms, as well as, I would say, you know, feminine art forms. And so he has this knowledge of this whole female culture that goes back. If you go to Greek and Roman statuary and artwork through time, going all the way back to the Garden of Eden, he likens his love for cars of the 30s and 40s and 50s because they were not only better made than cars of today and made of stronger materials, and just, which is something I'm going to say that permeates the entire scene, and why these people love this vintage culture of the 40s and 50s. Is because things were better made than they are today. You know, things had a strength and clothes lasted for a long time. There was an artistry to it all. But to say my partner Dane very much likened the form and shape and the artistry that went into the creation of the 1930s and 40s and 50s automobile, you know, had a very actually feminine quality. And those two things go together. You know, these women make their living by posing in photographs, you know, the concept of pinups. But I would say maybe back in the time and as well as today that 70% of photography that they do, there's an incorporation of an automobile and typically one of a classic era, not necessarily something new. And you can see that there's, you know, respect for certain artistic lines.
I don't know why, but I don't know very many people who do not love cars. I love cars. And that's another part of the film that I loved. Talk about the Rockabilly Weekend and what happens there. How does that all, can you kind of paint a picture for us?
Yeah. So there's a man named Tom Ingram who's a Brit, and he started out as a disc jockey in Britain, but he got very engaged in, you know, realizing that people celebrated this period of 40s and particularly 50s culture, and that they wanted to get together on weekends. And so there was an evolution of things in, particularly in the UK, called Weekenders, where people who loved rockabilly and that music and that clothing style and those cars, and they would get together with each other on a weekend at a park or a campground, et cetera, and play discs and dance and play music. And that was a movement that continued to grow. Tom moved to America and decided to continue his concept of these, you know, weekenders. And as it evolved and evolved and evolved, the Viva Las Vegas Rockabilly Weekend wasn't originally in Las Vegas, but made its way there. Well, this year it didn't happen, which is a whole other story and played a big part in the distribution of my film. But this would have been the 23rd year of Viva Las Vegas Rockabilly Weekend. And as I say, it attracts 25,000 people and is known worldwide as the preeminent event of this lifestyle and culture. And people come from all over the world. I'd say 25%, if not more, of the attendees international. So they're coming from the UK, they're coming from Korea, Japan, you know, Mexico, Australia, New Zealand, all over Europe. And so it's an incredibly international event where you go there and you're meeting people who are celebrating this primarily American culture, but loving it from all over the world. It's quite stunning.
It's wonderful.
They have like 80 bands that come up from all over the world and play over the course of the weekend, 1,000-car show, pinup ladies and dudes dressed up, and they have jitterbug dancing contests and trainings and things like that and everything, and hundreds and hundreds of vendors. It's quite an extravaganza.
What time of year is the festival normally?
Well, it's interesting. You know, so Tom was very smart when he finally started working with first the Gold Coast Hotel, but then with the Orleans Hotel. And he said to them, well, what weekend is your least active weekend here at the hotel? And let me take that and I'll fill you up. And they said, well, we don't have much business over Easter weekend every year. So he said, well, let me have Easter weekend. And now, as I say, it's a massive sellout. They sell out hotels all over Las Vegas for this event. And it's been a very happy relationship between him and the hotel.
I better hurry up and make my reservations. I'm going next year. I'm going to be there. I think this is going to be a lot of fun. You know, you talk about people coming from all over the world. This is not just an American event. And the women that are involved in the competition, in the pinup competition, what do you call that part of the competition?
There's two contests particularly engaging women. And there is the pinup contest, and there is also a burlesque contest. So that is something that also touches in the scene. I will make this distinction because a lot of people, you know, might conflate the two. And almost all burlesque artists, I would say, do practice a pinup and retro lifestyle and presentation. That not all pinups, though, are burlesque artists. And a burlesque artist do a form of clothing removal, but it's not quite striptease and it's not whatever. It's an art form. But as I say, not all pinups are burlesque artists, but I would say most all burlesque artists practitioners of a pinup presentation. So they have two contests. And then there's the burlesque contest, and there's this pinup contest where hundreds of women, you know, apply from around the world, and they winnow it down to 12 finalists. And it is based not just upon beauty and presentation, but it's definitely that's a component to it. But they're also looking for women who are engaged in their community and involved in some form of social activity and community engagement.
Well, these women, we think of pinups and we think of the stereotypical Betty Grable pinup that was on the walls during the war. But there are women here of all diverse backgrounds. I mean, I'm remembering a woman called Little Bit, who they call the lovely Latina, and Angelique Noir, who's absolutely stunning black model.
She was also known in some circles as the Black Barbie.
I love it. Beautiful.
Yeah. A lot of presentations of being that model, like a doll.
So where did you film? You went to Las Vegas. How many shoots did you have for this documentary?
Oh, hundreds.
Really?
Yes. But what I wanted to do was film these women in their native environments, and that meant two of them were from Brazil, you know, somebody from New Zealand, somebody from South Africa, two ladies from Australia, Canadians, people from all over the world. And when we realized that we didn't have the budget for myself and my crew to go to all of these nations, because we wanted to get their preparation of coming to the contest. And we started several months before. So we didn't have the budget to travel around the world and do segments as one might normally do on a competition type of, you know, show like this. And this movie does have its competition component, but it's not a competition movie, you know. So the competition kind of creates a bit of a timeline for us, but it isn't what the movie's about. It's not about the winning and the losing. It's part of it. But as you recognize in the scene, it's kind of all embracing, and kind of the beauty of it is that how the woman, even though they're competing, they're all extremely supportive of each other. But we didn't have the budget to go film abroad. So what we did next is we explored what it would cost to hire crews in each of these various, you know, countries to do a couple of day shoot with each of the women and find them, you know, in their work environment and their home environment, what their lifestyle is actually like in their home country and their home lifestyle and how they embrace this pinup lifestyle in their everyday life. But then we realized, oh, we don't even have the budget to hire these crews abroad. And so we came up with the concept of inviting each of the finalists to use their own smartphones and whatever other kind of camera equipment either they or associates had to film themselves. And we sent them a tutorial, kind of best practices on how to film themselves, things we wanted them to shoot or have their associates shoot. We sent them all tripods to hold their smartphones since we found out what kind of phone that they had. And then they started sending us material, as well as whatever other additional historical material they had of them through the course of their lives and things they found were important or the things that, you know, would allow us to kind of explore who they were, but also how they evolved into this pinup culture and found their way into it. And that became fascinating, you know, in the window to each of these women, found each of their avenues was quite different and was actually quite moving, how they found this to be an empowering way to express themselves.
And that's a wonderful idea, but that also makes post-production more complicated in terms of editing and logging. And I'm a bit of a workflow architect, and I'm thinking about, oh my goodness, when you were filming in Las Vegas, what cameras were you using? What was your sort of camera and sound setup, and how many people were on your crew there?
So we were using primarily Canon handheld SLR form.
Like a 5D or something like that?
Like 5Ds, yeah. And then also Sony A7s, very portable and very lightweight, movable equipment, and then the sound person. And when we filmed the contest, we had three crews because we had to diversify, you know, along, follow these, you know, 12 women through the course of their day. So we kind of had a schedule of getting a great number of the women, you know, where they're preparing, particularly in the morning of the contest and following them through the day. So we had kind of three crews racing around primarily all over the hotel on a very tight schedule. Then we, you know, had those three crews plus a couple additional cameras at the course of a contest, covering it from many different angles.
So you had your cameraman, a sound man. Did you have a field producer with each crew, or did you send them off to shoot?
No, we sent them off.
Uh-huh.
You know, but a very detailed, you know, shot list. And of course, you know, the invitation, too, to find, you know, to shoot anything they found fascinating. But yes, we had very organized shot lists for each crew, and then a check-in at various times during the day.
You know, I think people underestimate, who aren't familiar with documentary format, how much prep goes into these shoots, because everybody that you were filming, you had to talk with, or probably the key people you talked with ahead of time. You had given them the ability to shoot these diaries on location, and that there's a lot of coordination and then a lot of sort of sidestepping when things happen that you don't anticipate. This is a complicated project.
It is. Well, I have to take my hat off to my co-producer and also a cinematographer, Marie Eileen Ritalik, who was instrumental, not only, you know, for a number of reasons. She's a phenomenal cinematographer, but also she is a woman who felt it was very important to have female engagement with this. And I, you know, felt, you know, a bit unusual with my producing partner on the project, myself, were both men looking very much into a woman's world. And so we wanted to be very respectful and give very much a, you know, respectful point of view. And so I called upon Marie, you know, as a partner in doing all of that, as well as worked very closely with the creator of the contest, the pinup contest, who is really my key ally in moving into that world, along with Marie, was a woman named Raquel Perez, who goes by the name of Rockwell DeVille. That's her stage name, and you'll see all of these women operate with a stage persona. And there's a whole science that I can get into about having the stage persona, which allows them to kind of explore another aspect of their identity. So that's a whole other story. But I started with a female editor on the project.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what nonlinear system were you on? Were you on Premiere or Final Cut or Avid? What were you using?
It was crazy because we bounced back and forth. So we started in Premiere, and then my editor came on the project, worked primarily on Avid. And so we transcoded everything to Avid. And then as these things happen, my initial course of editing ran its course, and my editor had to move on to another job in another town. And when I brought in another editor, their methodology was working in Premiere. So call me crazy, but we moved back to Premiere.
No, I think it's smart. I mean, you have to allow an editor to use whatever tools they're used to. You want them to concentrate on the story and on building this for you. And if you put them in a new environment where they're also having to learn the new variations on another nonlinear system, I moved to Final Cut years ago, and I put my dongle with my Avid settings to the side and haven't even picked it up again. If somebody would ask me to help them with a project on either Premiere or Avid, I think I would try, but it would take a lot longer, and I would lose some of the enthusiasm for it because I'd have to be learning a new language. I think it's fine. You gave your editors the power to do what they do best, which is to edit for you.
And let me say another thing about that. Well, myself as both a writer, director, and producer on the project, you know, you're wearing multiple hats, but, you know, looking at the budget aspect of it, the thing that I had to consider in those transitions is that, oh, okay, to, you know, recode is one thing that's going to take whatever, you know, a week or two for my editor to get into, but also now the new editor has to familiarize themselves with all of the material. I was looking at 3 weeks to a month of paying an editor to actually not do any physical editing, but doing really all things on the system editing type of things, or not even that, just to get the material in the right place to start doing their job. So it's an expensive proposition, but it's one that's one of the bullets that one needs to swallow, or whatever the right terminology is. You know, they just go like, okay, this is going to take a month. There will not be any editing happening.
That's a fact of life. With documentary films, that's what it's all about. They have to learn the material. So let's talk about distribution for a moment. How did you start selling this? You're in the middle of filming it. You're post-producing it. Did you start pitching it early on, or did you wait till it was finished?
All along the way, this is like a very, very independent documentary. It wasn't done, you know, with any company. I had an initial investor, a woman named Amy Zakaner Levy, who my partner, producing partner, Dane Krogman, knew in Minnesota, who is an advocate for the documentary approach to this material in the first place, because she said television will just make a mess of this. And she was mainly talking about the female representation. And so she was an advocate for making a documentary. And she was our first investor, which allowed us to get started. But then my challenge along the way was to find additional money, which we explored through Indiegogo campaigns and were somewhat helpful. But making a film without being fully funded beforehand, it becomes quite an odyssey. And as one gets, you know, the only word to say is one gets more and more pregnant with a project, determination to finish becomes a objective and goal, but sometimes it's a difficulty mountain to surmount, you know, by the filmmaker. And I just determined as I went along the way, it's like, I've got to finish this. I got to finish this. In some ways, you know, became money out of my own pocket to keep going. And much to my family's chagrin, I got to continue. I can't let this go. It needs to live. It needs to get out there. And I just had to keep moving. And so I had to enroll my wife in all of that. And so she is indeed an executive producer on the project. It's her support.
That's nice. I think when you're a documentary filmmaker, your family has to be very patient with you, because these are not like scripted. Scripted, you know how long it's going to take to film. You know what you're going to get. You hire your crew, you start shooting, you post-produce it, you know, you distribute it. With a documentary, you don't know where the story's going to go. If someone would ask you, why is this film important now, what would you tell them?
I would tell them that in this era of the Me Too era, this is a great film to exhibit a particular form of female empowerment. It's non-traditional, non-typical, would not be something that we started this conversation that would expect this to be a empowerment film for women. And this presents an opening for women to say like, oh, I can find my expression and own my femininity and my womanhood in my own way. And it's up to me. It's not up to any kind of societal convention or expectation from any particular group or media outlet or anything like that. It's my own voice. And I think that's something that one will discover in seeing this film, is saying these women found a way to express themselves that they can own and they find incredibly empowering and embraces all aspects of themselves.
Well, I think it's wonderful. Where can people go?
There's also DVDs for sale, which they can get on Amazon, or they could also contact me, and that's dan@bombshellsanddollies.com. That's just Dan, my name, Dan, @bombshellsanddollies, all written out with and between Bombshells and Dollies, Dollies plural.
Bombshells and Dollies, DOLLIES.com. Yeah, I urge everybody to go there and check it out.
We have a distributor and it's out there. I want everyone to know also that I was to premiere and promote the film at Viva Las Vegas Rockabilly Weekend this past April. And of course, we're in the midst of a pandemic. And because of quarantine, Viva Las Vegas didn't happen. I had hundreds of DVDs that I was taking to the event to sell, and also to have the number of the stars of the film to be there to promote it and to do autographs, essentially make money back on the film. You know, mine is just one of a million, you know, tragic stories in this particular time, so I'm not looking for any particular sympathy, but it's just the fact of the matter is that, you know, this is another story of how opportunity was so in front of us and got dashed because of the epidemic.
I do wish you the best with it, and I encourage everybody to go to bombshellsanddollies.com and buy the DVD. And we've got a couple of minutes left. I want to ask you about one of your next projects. You have a great eye for story. You have several things in researching for this and in talking with you over the years. You really do have a great eye for story. Talk to me about your next one for a moment. We are going to bring you back on to go into more detail about it. But tell us a little bit about the one that's closest to your heart right now that you are in prep for.
Sure. Up until a few months ago, I was co-chair of diversity and inclusion at the Producers Guild of America. And stories that are going to make a difference or affect society in some kind of positive way, either environmentally or socially, have always been meaningful to me. And that's one thing that I felt very strongly about with Bombshells and Dollies, that was a story that was empowering to women. And this story that I'm going to tell you about is based on a true story, and it's called Both Ends of the Gun. And it's a true story about two fathers of different faiths, races, and cultures who ultimately, despite their differences, have to come together and learn to forgive and heal after the son of one of the fathers tragically and senselessly murders the son of the other father. But not only how, for most people, they would see that as great tragedy to happen to the families and certainly to two young people, which could have been the end of the life of one boy who was murdered and of the other who was going to be sent to adult prison for the rest of his life, that this was instead turned into a movement by the two fathers to help stop kids from killing other kids. So, you know, it is looking at how a tragedy possibly can turn into something positive, and especially when people are willing to embrace a different course than a traditional course and be able to explore things like redemption and forgiveness and love and understanding, which are really kind of key elements, obviously, of great importance to society today, both through everything that's been leading up to this moment, but, you know, the pandemic, as well as the moment of George Floyd, because of the two fathers. One is a Muslim of Middle Eastern descent, the father of the murder victim, and then the father of the murderer was an African-American Christian. There's no way other than the events, tragic events of the story, where these two men's lives really would have crossed and where they would have been able to become entwined with each other and being, you know, kind of the greatest advocate for the other one's salvation in a way.
Well, it's an inspiring story. I remember hearing about it in the news, and you've been working on this one for a while. It seems to me like there's not a better time than now to be thinking about this. And I believe that one of the fathers started a nonprofit foundation.
Yes. Azim Kamisa, the father of the murder victim, is an international investment banker living in La Jolla, a Tony suburb of San Diego. and not somebody who is particularly engaged or aware of the challenges that exist in the inner city. And his son, Tarek, a 20-year-old San Diego State college student, had a weekend job delivering pizzas. And on a Saturday night, he delivered a pizza to a false address, and he was held up in a gang initiation of a street gang and was murdered by a 14-year-old who had a gun put in his hand by the 19-year-old gang leader and instructed to bust the pizza man when the pizza man didn't turn over, you know, the pizzas and his pizza money. You know, Azeem, as I say, was a Muslim of Middle Eastern descent and an American immigrant. But when he was informed that his only and beloved son had been murdered, he couldn't continue with his career at all. He was lost, suicidal, and rather directionless in life. And then an imam at his mosque told them acts of compassion done in the name of the deceased, feed the soul's journey. So what he came up to help advance his son's movement in his Muslim tradition towards heaven, he created a foundation in his son's name to stop kids from killing kids and teach inner city at-risk youth nonviolent forms of conflict resolution so that no other child or family or father need suffer the same fate as he and his family had and his son had. And that was the birth of the Tarek Kanisa Foundation, which is now in its 24th year.
How do we spell Tarek Kanisa for those who are listening?
And one can go to tkf.org. But it is spelled T-A-R-I-Q, and Kamisa is K-H-A-M-I-S-A. But tkf.org is the access to that point. And the name of the film is Both Ends of the Gun.
Well, that's wonderful. So where do they go to watch a trailer or find something about Both Ends of the Gun?
The one thing is they can contact, you know, me, and I can tell them more about it. And that's Dan at epiphanypictures.com, and Epiphany, E-P-I-P-H-A-N-Y. Pictures, P-I-C-T-U-R-E-S.com. And there is a wonderful, wonderful TED Talk between the two men, Azeem Kanisa and Plus Felix, and has well over a million views. And that's available, you know, on YouTube.
Yeah, I think that's when I first heard about it. Now, you're also on Twitter at
Dananapeel.
Dananapeel. I love that. D-A-N-A-N-A-P-E-E-L. Are you on Instagram at all?
Yes, Dan.Halperin.
Dan.Halperin, H-A-L-P-E-R-I-N, on Instagram. And if you go to Facebook, you'll see Bombshells and Dollies. And also, Dan, you're on Facebook as an individual. And I do encourage people to check out both films. Watch Bombshells and Dollies. It's great fun. And, you know, I love that these projects, on the one hand, with Bombshells and Dollies, you're empowering women to just find joy and strength and comfort in their femininity. And on the other, you're helping to teach conflict resolution and love and respect for people who are different from us and for people who have made mistakes. There is an incredible power in that level of forgiveness. I just want to encourage anyone listening to support you however they can, to watch your projects. And Dan, we're going to bring you back on again to talk more about Both Ends of the Gun. And I thank you so much for taking this time today.
If I can say one more thing about Both
Sure.
Ends of the Gun, and that is that, you know, the murderer in the story, Tony Hicks, who was 14 at the time that he committed the murder, he did plead guilty. And he, at 14, though, was the youngest individual in California to be convicted and sentenced as an adult and was committed to 25 years to life in adult prison. In the story, Azeem ultimately, the father of the murder victim, ultimately forgives Tony and not only did that and visited in prison over the 24 years, whatever, campaigned for Tony's early release. And he also promised Tony a job when he got out of prison to come and work for the Tarek Kanisa Foundation. And I am pleased to say that earlier this year, Tony did attain parole after Azeem also being in attendance at the parole hearing, speaking on behalf of Tony's release. And Tony is now out and starting to engage in the activities of the Tarek Kanisa Foundation and also apprenticing as a plumber. It's a kind of a beautiful fulfillment, and he is very closely engaged with, you know, Azeem and Tarek's sister, Tazreen, who's the executive director of the Tarek Kanisa Foundation. And just thinking of how many lives that Tony can help save by telling his story.
Especially now. Well, everyone listening, let's help him get this stuff done. We'll be talking to you again soon. Thank you so much for doing this today. And that was Dan Halperin, an independent filmmaker, a television producer and director, the producer-director of Bombshells and Dollies, and in development on both ends of the gun. I'm Serena Catania, signing off for today. And remember what I tell you guys, get up off your chair and go do something wonderful today. Until next time, have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.
OWC Radio is sponsored by Otherworld Computing. Visit maxsales.com and check out the new Thunderblade X8 drives for the world's fastest speeds. Work smarter, faster, and more creatively with OWC Solutions.